broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning. I'm Steve Brown, welcoming you into this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD-HD. A very special program this morning. I'll have three guests. First of all, John Tinker, whose U.S. Supreme Court case of Tinker versus Des Moines, decided back in 1969, still remains the number one court case dealing with the freedom of speech and freedom of expression for school students and for teachers. And also we'll be joined by Professor Justin Driver, who's professor of law at Yale University in their School of Law in New Haven, Connecticut. And finally, Mark Walsh, who is a contributing writer for Education Week, who focuses in on issues related to school law. In addition, we'll be discussing the cheerleader case coming up this coming week by the U.S. Supreme Court on April 28th. And this is the court case that took place in Mahonoy, Pennsylvania, when a cheerleader decided to post something on her Snapchat that got her removed from the cheerleading team. And now, Education Matters.
Joining me as co-host is John Tinker. John, hello.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here with you again. And want to say hi to Professor Justin Driver and Mark Walsh. Glad to have you aboard here today.
Let me first introduce our two very, very special guests. First of all, Professor Justin Driver. He's currently the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law at Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. He teaches and writes in the area of constitutional law. He's also the author of a wonderful book that I've used in my school law class and have always made sure that our students are aware of it. It's called The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. Now, we're going to be talking about the book written by Professor Driver. The book was also selected as a Washington Post Notable Book of the Year, an Editor's Choice of the New York Times Book Review, and it received the Stephen S. Goldberg Award for Distinguished Scholarship in Educational Law. Professor Driver, thank you, was also at the University of Chicago. He's a graduate of Brown University, Oxford University, where he was a Marshall Scholar, Duke University, where he received his certification to teach public school. And we're going to talk about that, by the way, Professor Driver, about your experiences all across the board. And also Harvard Law School, where he was editor of the Harvard Law Review. And also, just as a sidebar, a major sidebar, after graduating from Harvard, the professor clerk for Judge Merrick Garland, who's now our United States Attorney General. And we know that he had been nominated by President Obama way back when, I think in 2016, earlier in 2016, prior to the election. And we're not going to get political here, but they did not allow any sort of discussion. But now he's the Attorney General of the United States. And he also clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who's now retired, of course, from the U.S. Supreme Court, and Justice Stephen Breyer. And we'll talk more about all those experiences. Also joining us, Mark Walsh. Mark, I like to refer to you as the consummate reporter and the person who lets us all know what's going on in the area of school law. He writes for the very prestigious publication, which is Education Week. First of all, you know, one of the things that that we're going to talk about today, of course, will be Professor Driver's book, At the Schoolhouse Gate. I wanted to first start with you, Professor Driver. As you look at the overall landscape right now, how do you see the issues of school law at the intersection of school law and the whole area of law with regards to the U.S. Supreme Court and rulings that they have made, let's just say, since Morse v. Frederick, Bond Hits for Jesus?
Well, let me begin by saying how honored and delighted I am to be with you all today. It's a real treat for me to speak about my book. With respect to where the court has been over the last 14 years or so, I think it's notable primarily for its inaction in this area. The Supreme Court has issued desperately few decisions involving students' constitutional rights. One of the few notable decisions in this area involves the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures, a case involving a young woman, a middle school student called Savannah Redding, who was strip searched for ibuprofen tablets on suspicion of that contraband. Incredibly, modest notion of contraband. This is the sort of pain reliever that one can buy at any drugstore across the nation. The Supreme Court found that that search was unconstitutional, but the rule that it held, that it handed down, offered, in my own view, insufficient protection to students' rights. But when I think you step back and look at what the court has done over the last 14 or 15 years, it is, again, notable primarily for its inaction. I wish that the court were more active in this area, and I am heartened that they have agreed to hear the cheerleader case that you referenced a moment ago.
And Mark, in your role with regards to covering the U.S. Supreme Court, with regards to court decisions and discussions about education in particular, what's your perspective in terms of how the court, let's say over the last 10 years, has made decisions? How has that impacted education in general? What's your perspective on how the court's rulings over the last 10 years or so have impacted education and specifically school law?
Well, thanks, Steve. And again, just it's great for me to be here. You talk about the last 10 years. Justin made a great point about the Redding case in 2009. There then was like a five-year period at least, and because then I wrote a story that said, the Supreme Court has not taken up any cases involving school districts or school administrators as the parties for this five-year period, and it actually then extended beyond that. And there are, a couple reasons for that that I'll quickly say that I do think some members of the court don't think they should be getting too much into this. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, was asked at a public forum soon after the Redding decision about that case, and said, paraphrasing him, he said, we really probably don't do a great job, running local governments, and we should try and stay out of that when we can. And Professor Driver's former boss at the court, Justice Breyer, has even, written in opinions about some of his concerns about the Supreme Court becoming the National School Board, or the which another justice once talked about the problems with that.
John, as you listen to all of this, and obviously the case of Tinker versus Des Moines was decided back in 1969. Abe Fortas in the 7-2 decision, obviously we always like to recite some of the key words in there, that students and teachers don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. And it was interesting. As you listen to this and as you look at your experiences over the years, what's your perspective with regards to how the court's decisions in the since 1969?
First off, I'm not a lawyer. Neither am I a scholar of the law, but I'm kind of a participant in education law. Besides the cases that have kind of chopped the sides off of our case a little bit, the Frazier case and the Morris v. Frederick case, especially the Hazelwood case, which did a significant hit to student journalism, in my opinion. I've just been watching the effect on education itself, on the students, and the way the students have been presenting themselves. Really, that's my involvement mostly, is in email exchanges, video exchanges with classrooms, and so on. And I find it that the movement in education from 50 years ago until the present, I find it's been progressive and encouraging. I just wanted to mention, with regard to Professor Driver's book, the subtitle of that book is Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. And to me, that's really one of the most important aspects, is the battle for the American mind, because we have the constitutional system, we have the jurisprudence that has established where we are with regard to the law, but the American mind and the American public and the social movements that are happening within that legal context, I think that's the really fascinating part of what's going on.
Sure. Any comments or reactions from either you, Mark, or Professor Driver?
Yeah, I'd like to jump in here and just begin by saluting Mr. Tinker for his stand in 1965. You know, it took tremendous courage for Mr. Tinker and his, relatives and friends in order to protest the Vietnam War at a time when the Vietnam War was not much thought about. And to the extent that people thought about it, they were generally in favor. One of the things that I try to do in my book is to shine a spotlight on the brave students and their families who filed this litigation, because it typically involves them standing up against not only school authorities, but also their surrounding communities. And as I understand it, the Tinker household was pelted with, you know, vitriol and even, a bucket of red paint was splattered on the front door, with the implication being that only a communist or red would dare to oppose the Vietnam War. And so too often in law schools, it seems to me that we pay a lot of attention to lawyers and to, judges, right? And they certainly deserve some attention, but the litigants themselves are too often forgotten. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do in my book. The other thing that I would say is, I think that, Mr. Tinker is exactly right when he suggests that there is a battle that one can see for the American mind that happens in these Supreme Court opinions. And the Tinker case is a really sort of powerful testament to this. You see a very pitched battle between the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion about the notion of citizenship. Everybody agrees that schools are creating citizens, but Justice Fortas's opinion for the majority says that yes, we are creating citizens, and it's exactly for that reason that people need to be able to agree on the issues of the day with an eye toward the marketplace of ideas functioning well, that ours is a relatively open, often disputatious society, and in effect that it would be odd if our schools did not assume that same character.
And also, with regards to what you were saying, Professor Driver, you mentioned on page 77, you say, finally, Tinker's least speech restrictive reading, school officials could not justify prohibiting student expression based on their classmates' disruptive reactions to the speech, but instead must look to whether the speakers themselves disrupted school activities, while students who espouse unpopular viewpoints may create discomfort and unpleasantness. Tinker, the court decision, maintained that educators may not censor expression out of a desire to avoid those sensations. As I read that, John, what was running through your mind when I'm saying that while students who espouse unpopular viewpoints may create discomfort and unpleasantness?
I think that that goes to the point of the First Amendment. And I think it's a very mature and well-expressed understanding of the First Amendment and the need for freedom of speech in a democracy.
As you were listening to some of these comments, and as it relates specifically, as I quoted from your book, Professor, what were some of your thoughts and what else would you like to add to all of this?
Yeah, so the portion of my book that you read suggests that the Tinker decision admits of multiple readings. Regrettably, in my view, the reading that has predominated of Tinker fastens in on this language that says it's permissible for teachers to punish students if there is a reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption, a reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption. While I acknowledge that that opinion by Justice Fortas really struck a blow for students' rights at the time, it was completely plausible that there would have been a contrary decision saying that if the school administrators say you can't say it, then you can't say it, and it's permissible for them to be punished. Nevertheless, I wish that subsequent courts had gone further still in protecting student speech, because the language about reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption, which is known as the Tinker test, can be understood to read in what First Amendment mavens would refer to as a heckler's veto. This is the idea that particularly sensitive listeners can, if they object vociferously enough, shut down otherwise legitimate speech. And so the lower courts have heard these cases that might be regarded as heckler's vetoes and permitted the heckler's veto to carry the day. Let me give you a very sort of crisp example from the last 15 years or so. There were students in California who wished to wear clothing featuring the American flag, and they were instructed by school officials to turn that clothing inside out that featured the American flag. That was permitted to carry the day. Now, the students were wearing this clothing on May the 5th, aka Cinco de Mayo, and some students took exception and thought that the students who were wearing the clothing with the American flag were in effect trolling them and saying, some of the students said, what's the matter? You don't like Mexicans. And while I understand the frustration, I do think that to the extent that anyone's going to be suspended, it should be the folks who are sort of, you know, threatening, violence and disrupting rather than simply wearing the clothing featuring the American flag. So these heckler's veto cases are concerning. I, for one, am more drawn toward the approach of a district court in Rhode Island, where there was a young man, this is a long time ago in the early 80s, who wished to bring another young man to prom as his date. The school officials get wind of it and they say, oh no, we've had some, you know, fisticuffs in school over sexual orientation. We can't guarantee your safety. And the district court said, that is impermissible. This young man wishes to express his sexual orientation through his choice of a date. And if people take exception to them, then they should be, in effect, disciplined, but not the person who is doing something that is within his constitutional rights. And I wish that more courts would follow that approach from that pretty obscure district court decision out of Rhode Island many years ago.
This is from ABC News. I want to give them full credit. This and it's entitled "Teen Cheerleaders Snapchat Bring Supreme Court Clash," and in particular, there's a brief interview with Brandi Levy.
At 14 years old, Brandi Levy thought cheerleading was her life.
I really enjoyed how I could go and like support other teammates. And I also really liked the stunts.
So in 2017, when she didn't make the varsity cut as a freshman to cheer for the Mahanoy Golden Bears, Brandi sounded off like teenagers are known to do.
I was angry. And I made a post on Snap. I said it was F school, F cheer, F softball, F everything.
And I bet you thought once you sent that, and anybody that knows Snap knows those messages disappear, bet you thought you'd never hear about it again.
No, I didn't think I would.
But the school got wind of the message, posted off campus and on a weekend, and came down hard, suspending Brandi from cheerleading for an entire year, saying she breached a code of conduct.
They told me that I'm lucky I didn't get expelled from school for it, because it was vulgar language.
Her father, Larry Levy, was stunned.
If they would have just took her and said to her, Brandi, you know, kind of watch, just be careful what you're saying or you're doing. But as far as the action they took, I think that was far reached above and beyond where they should be.
With help from the ACLU, the Levys sued the school in federal court for violating Brandi's freedom of speech. And they won, a judge ordering Brandi returned to the team. And later in a sweeping decision, a federal appeals court said a school's authority to enforce the rules does not apply off campus.
When they're not under their school supervision, kids are under their parents' supervision, and the parents are the ones who should be able to decide what's appropriate for their children to say when they're at home.
The Mahanoy School District says the decision threatens to handcuff coaches, principals, and teachers nationwide, and later this month will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The First Amendment is not a territorial straitjacket that forces schools to ignore speech that disrupts the school environment, the district writes in court documents. The Supreme Court, in a famous 1969 decision, gave schools the right to limit disruptive speech on school property, but has never weighed in on school-related speech expressed off campus after school hours.
This case is so important because it has implications not just for school leaders in Pennsylvania, but across the nation to be able to provide for the safety and welfare of students in their schools.
Paul Healy represents hundreds of Pennsylvania school principals back in the district.
Why do schools need to be able to police student speech after hours off campus?
If somebody says something offline, like in a school or something, and you would discipline for that, then you should be able to do the same thing if they do it online. That type of language and that type of rhetoric causes the school harm and could cause a disruption in the school.
How does it cause disruption just to sound off like a teenager would after being cut from the team?
I think there's a place and a forum for that as well. But again, social media takes it to another step.
Social media is the front line in the battle against teenage cyberbullying, a top concern of parents and school administrators, as roughly one in three American middle or high school students say they've been victims. Research shows the threat of punishment by schools is a key deterrent to would-be bullies.
If they perceived that they would get in trouble at school for cyberbullying, they were significantly less likely to do it. If the courts come down and say, look, if it happens out, away from school, there's nothing you can do about it, I think that's going to potentially open up a lot of concern.
For Brandi Levy, the public spotlight was never something she wanted.
If you had 5 minutes with administrators today about this case, what would you say to them?
I was 14. You should be able to, like, cut me some slack.
She says she hopes the Supreme Court decides schools must do just that.
I just want the Supreme Court to realize that every person and every student and young adults have their freedom of speech, and that the schools can't punish students for what they say outside of school.
Do you really feel that?
If it was like threatening someone or bullying or like harassing or like stuff like that, they should. But like mine was, I wasn't threatening anyone.
Do you regret sending the FU snap now all these years later?
Now that I think about it, I feel like I shouldn't have done it, but it is what it is. I was 14. I was young. I wasn't thinking.
Regret but no apology from Brandi Levy as her school and teenage Snapchatters everywhere look to where the justices will draw the line over the First Amendment. For ABC News, I'm Devin Dwyer in Mahanoy City, Pennsylvania.
Mark, you have covered this story very extensively. You've interviewed Brandi Levy. You've interviewed others. But as you listen to all of that, Mark, and with your insight into this, give me your reaction as you listen to Brandi, especially since you have interviewed her, and you'll be covering the case on April 28th in just a few days.
Sure. So there's a lot going on in this case. I'm glad you played that report. I know Devin, who's the reporter there. He's the producer for ABC News at the court, and I think he produced a good, fair look at this case, including noting that the school district is not giving interviews, but there's a very interesting brief from the Pennsylvania Principals Association and the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. And of course, the briefs, you can get a lot of information on the case. So I think that's a good starting point. So a couple, you say we're going to get into some of the specifics. So one thing I'll just observe is that the speech that Brandi Levy put forth in her Snapchat, which we're not going to discuss too much of the specifics of that, I don't think, but is quite a distance away from the black armbands that John and Mary Beth Tinker and others wore to protest the Vietnam War.
When you read the federal district court filings and the U.S. Supreme Court filings, I counted between the two of those filings no less than 35 or 40 references, obviously, to the Tinker case. My question for you and also for you, Professor Driver, how do you think all this is going to play? What does your crystal ball tell you at this point, Mark, as the court's going to hear this next week and come up with their decision in early June?
I'm not sure my crystal ball tells me. One thing I was going to point out was that there are four members of the court left who participated in Morse versus Frederick, which is what Professor Driver, the Bong Hits for Jesus banner case that the professor was talking about. All four of those members of the court are either in the conservative bloc or Justice Breyer actually voted in the bottom line judgment, at least for the school district in that case. But there's a lot you could look at because all four also wrote opinions in that case and viewed the case in different ways. And so that's what, we're coming to now. We have five other members of the court who don't have a big track record on school speech. So we just, we're not sure where it's going to go from that perspective.
I cannot understand the Third Circuit opinion that's coming to the court now. I cannot understand how the court would expect the schools to keep track of what's going on in social media and police it. It just seems like an impossible task. I mean, I sincerely hope they don't try to send things that way, but I can't understand how it would be possible for the school systems to police social media.
And your take on this, Professor?
I think this is the most momentous student speech case since Tinker, actually. The subsequent cases that have been decided have carved out exceptions to Tinker, but here we're thinking about a tremendous amount of speech these days happens off campus, but online. And this case raises quite clearly how much school officials can go into regulating that material. I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court will vindicate Levy's claim and decide in effect to uphold the Third Circuit's rationale. I could imagine a narrower ruling than that was issued by the majority in the Third Circuit, embracing in effect Judge Ambrose's decision, which said in effect, even if tinker and the reasonable forecast of substantial disruption does apply to off-campus speech, that this speech did not rise to a reasonable forecast of a substantial disruption. And it's important to remember that the way that Brandi Levy was punished was different than the way that the Tinkers were punished in the 1960s. Levy was not suspended from school as happened with Tinker. Instead, she was thrown off of the junior varsity cheerleading team for a year. And you could imagine, I anticipate some of the justices asking questions that are designed to test the boundaries of this case. What if, rather than suspending her for the whole year, she were forced to sit out, you know, one sort of cheerleading meet, right, or something along those lines? And conversely, there could be some questions that are designed to test the borders of what amounts to off-campus speech. And of course, some of the briefs in this case say the rise of the smartphone renders that famous language about the schoolhouse gate a nullity because, given that students have access to the internet on their persons basically at all time, there is no such thing as speech that happens beyond the schoolhouse gate. But I find that to be, that would be a deeply troublesome rule.
Mm-hmm. One interesting thing when you were talking, Mark, about the current justices, Justice Alito is going to be an interesting person. And I know, Mark, you're aware of this as, because you were at an event back in 2013 when the court, in particular Justice Alito, sponsored an event featuring the Tinker decision. And you write about it, you wrote about it back then. Before I ask you to comment a bit on that, Mark, John, you were sitting right next to Justice Alito back in 2013. You and your son Fisher were sitting right next to the justice. Share with us the conversation that you had directly with Justice Alito.
Yeah, this happened after the event. We got up and shook hands and so on. And I reminded Justice Alito that during his confirmation hearing, he had been asked about our case and what his opinion about it was. And he said that he considered it to be stare decisis, already decided. And so I asked him if he still had that same opinion. And he said that yes, he did, that he said, basically, I hope that your case stands for a long time. It was essentially what he said. And I took a great comfort from that. And I take also comfort from the fact that a lot of what I would call more conservative, the fundamentalist religious people, the political right, also, there are a lot of them that support our case because they also have things they want to say, and I support their right to say what they have to say. So anyway, I took comfort from what Justice Alito said to me that evening, and I hope he remembers it the same way.
Mark, as you remember back to 2013, what were some of your thoughts then, and what are they now?
Well, as I pointed out, this was an event at the Supreme Court Historical Society, and someone gave a lecture about it. And the rule of the Historical Society, these are events held in the courtroom in the evening, and there's supposed to be a justice present. There usually is, unless someone just can't make it. And Justice Alito was the one who introduced the speaker, and John and Mary Beth and their families were there, and really it was quite a warm introduction and just a discussion of the Tinker case that make one believe, and there's other evidence to rely on that Justice Alito is not there with Justice Thomas about thinking Tinker should be overruled. You can read his concurrence in Morse versus Frederick and where he ruled against the student in that case, but he did seemed to place the value on Tinker as a precedent, and talked about other kinds of speech, and as well about school officials potentially, you know, abusing their disciplinary authority in this area. But it was just a very nice event.
And sort of wrapping things up about this discussion about the cheerleader case, as it's being called. One of the things that's pointed out, by the way, in a review of your book, The Schoolhouse Gate, it said, one of the most appealing features of the Schoolhouse Gate is its relative absence of ideological one-sidedness. Driver expresses the hope that libertarian-infected vision of limited government now ascendant in some learning circles. Your book covers so many different cases, and obviously the Tinker case, the title. But when you decided on the title for the book, how important was it at that particular time that you decided to include as the hallmark title, The Schoolhouse Gate?
Yes. So with respect to the first part of your question about the libertarian aspect of this, I'm hopeful that the cheerleader case is one where the liberal members of the court and those drawn to libertarian conceptions of free speech will find common cause here. Obviously, our nation is deeply divided these days, but this is one area where liberals and libertarians should be able to agree that the state should have grave difficulty in silencing student speech. And so it does seem incumbent on me for, you know, people who are liberals like myself to think about areas where they can find common cause. So, you know, I also want to say, you know, in response to, you know, something that Mark said a while back about the speech in question as being a long way away from the armbands that were at issue opposing the Vietnam War. And on some level, that must be true, right? That speaking out against, you know, America's engagement with the war is sort of core political speech. In a way, a vulgar comment about an extracurricular activity is small, but you know, on another level, they're not so distinct as they seem at first blush. This is to the very word that Levy used is also the subject of one of the most important cases in this area, Cohen versus California, right? Where someone wore a jean jacket that said, in effect, you know, and it seems to me important, Harlan wrote there, which is that, you know, one person's vulgarity is another person's lyric, you know, and the way that Levy expressed herself is quite common. I have it on good authority among teenagers all across the country. And we want to be, you know, careful about silencing this sort of speech that happens, you know, off campus and far away. As to the title, yes, I chose that with a great amount of care, and I did it in order to pay homage to Justice Fortas's sort of stirring opinion, and of course the sacrifice of the Tinker family as well. And the thing that I was going for there was that students' constitutional rights that the Constitution assumes a particular form behind the schoolhouse gate. And it's different than the rights that minors have when they are in the public park across the street afterward. A more sort of robust conception of constitutional rights attached to minors when they are in the public park. And so I really wanted to think hard about the particular constitutional form that the document assumes when we are on schools. And I'm trying to provide a panoramic look so that I'm looking at not just free speech rights, but also search and seizure and, you know, punishment in the form of suspensions and corporal punishment and racial equality, and just give a wide look, because I think that many students and teachers, for that matter, are interested in this area of law, but might be intimidated by legal decisions. And I tried to write the book in a way that would be accessible to non-lawyers so that they could understand these foundational decisions that shape the lives of some 50 million students when they are in public schools all across the nation.
John, final comments from you?
Well, I think that, yes, thank you. I think that the location of the schoolhouse gate is really what this current, the Mahoney VBL case is about. Does the schoolhouse gate reach out into the internet these days? I think there's some indication that it does reach out somewhat into the internet. And I think that the question is, how far does it reach? And I sincerely hope that the court will constrain the boundary of the schoolhouse gate in some way. And I think they have to, basically. So I just want to say thank you to Professor Driver and Mark Walsh. Thank you so very much for participating in our podcast.
I do think that your audience, whether it's students or anyone else, should, if they're interested in this, should take a look at the briefs. You can find them at SCOTUS blog, my blog. And there's a brief there from on the student side from a friend of the court brief by John and Mary Beth Tinker. And they do address actually the question of speech that's not the same as the armbands they wore. And that brief does argue that is as deserving of First Amendment protection as other speech. And then I would just remind your audience, because I was surprised a couple of lawyers asked me about this week. They weren't aware that the court is you know, still operating under pandemic conditions and holding its arguments over the telephone, that is available to everyone live or later, or you know, C-SPAN is the best place to sort of go find that. But next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern is the future of student speech is kind of on the line, and anyone can listen in on that.
I have one last comment as well, and I want to tell people that they need to read Mark Walsh on, you know, students' decisions and everything. He is an invaluable resource for people in this field, and his work is very much translating what the court is deciding in a way that is accessible to all sorts of people. And he is a national treasure in that regard. So I'm very grateful to him, as I know many members of my community are.
In closing, I would really like to thank Mark Walsh, who's contributing writer for Education Week. And I certainly agree with everything that Professor Driver just said about Mark. Your journalism degree at Northwestern University and all the things that you do are sincerely appreciated. And teaching school law at a number of universities, Mark, as you know, I always reference your work and your writings. A few years ago, we were all at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Mark was there, John Tinker, Mary Beth Tinker, Dan Johnston, who was the attorney who has since passed away, and Christopher Eckhart was there, who passed away several years ago as well. So I'd like to thank you, Mark, for everything that you do. And Professor Driver, who's currently the Robert R. Slaughter Professor of Law at the Yale Law School. And thanks to both of you for participating in this. Obviously, the court decision will come out sometime in June, as it normally does, and it will be quite fascinating. Again, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Steve Brown. And John, final words from you?
Oh, thanks. Thanks to you all. Thank you, Steve, by the way, for doing a great job. And wonderful to meet you, Professor Driver. Good to see you again, Mark Walsh.
And this has been Education Matters here on WGTD-HD. And I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. I would once again like to thank our guest, Professor Justin Driver, Professor of Law at Yale University, Mark Walsh, a contributing writer for Education Week, and John Tinker, whose court case of Tinker versus Des Moines still remains the number one case dealing with freedom of speech and freedom of expression for students. For Education Matters and WGTDHD, I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters.